been destroyed because of this freak. I won't allow it!
These babies just saved this lame best party!
Welcome this week to This Week in Geek. I am Mr. Christopher. I am filling in for Mike the Birdman Dodd, who is having some internet problems this week and is unable to join us on our recording. I am joined, however, with Alex, our producer. How are you doing this week, Alex?
I'm doing quite well, and Michael's being a bit of a baby. My internet doesn't work. No, I'd be in the same boat with him. It's frustrating when it works intermittently and you have like dial-up connection, even though you're paying for like 500 meg internet. So
I feel like that's so much worse than just not having internet at all, is being able to kind of connect to the internet and just to give you enough hope where you're like, oh, maybe it works now. Oh, no, it doesn't work. Okay, maybe it works now. Oh, nope, it doesn't. Just to fuck with you some more.
Yeah, he had just enough connectivity so that he could finish some of his reviews and elements, but that was about it.
It's got to be frustrating. Like, I live on the internet, and I know he does too. It's just become such a staple that when you don't have it, you start to realize how much you rely on it every single day. And I think a lot more people now need the internet to survive.
Well, and in his case, he's somebody who has a lot of connected devices. Like, his whole house is Google Homed up. So he, you know, is doing voice commands for a lot of things. And well, he doesn't have like a radio clock. It's connected to the internet. So
yeah, and music, all the background music that just kind of highlights the little elements of his life, and all of a sudden you can't do that. You can't have your favorite radio station on in the background because you used an internet service to get that radio station, or you're listening to Spotify music. All of a sudden you can't do that either. Yeah. You have to rely on conventional radio, which not a lot of people even have anymore.
See, I do have a conventional radio. I have a little one that I can plug in if I need to, but I'm down in like the basement. Like, it's a first floor apartment, but it's half buried underground. So, you know, I can only get a few stations in. And in the case of like Birdman, his favorite radio stations are American. So good luck with that.
It's not something you can exactly listen to just every day, all the way up here in Guelph, Ontario. But this week we have a show, of course. We have our regular segments. We have the news this week, which we're going to talk about some YouTube and some Dungeons and Dragons stuff. A little later, we'll talk about the weird news, the just plain wacky, the just plain messed up stuff. PewDiePie is involved with the show, only in spirit, not actually here. That'd be kind of cool. MySpace has been having some problems, but nobody noticed for about a year, of course.
I'll bet you Birdman noticed.
Probably, but nobody uses MySpace anymore, so nobody cared until now. And something about Russia, but we'll get back to that a little bit later. The last week or so, I have been back to work. My vacation ended, and that made me sad because the only vacation that'll ever be long enough will be retirement. And I don't think that'll ever happen for me, personally.
Retirement and death?
Mostly death. I'll have a good vacation when I'm dead. Otherwise, the From Software game Sekiro Shadows Die Twice came out. And I've played a little bit of that so far, and holy crap, is it hard. I'm a Dark Souls veteran, and I have platinumed the first Dark Souls, almost platinumed the second Dark Souls, and this game is kicking the ever-loving shit out of me. And I've never played anything quite like it. You have to completely unlearn everything you've ever learned playing Dark Souls games just to survive this one. So it's brought a new dimension of challenge and difficulty. It's still fair. It's still From Software style of challenging, but it's never cheap. So I like it. I dig it. I'm going to have a review for that coming up sometime soon, as soon as I can play enough of it and get enough of it actually completed to give it a fair representation of that. So that's been taking up my gaming time for the last little while. What have you been up to, Alex?
I've been visiting family for the last few days, getting some stuff sorted out for my brother's wedding, getting suit fitted and all this sort of, all the little alterations you got to do in that. So as far as gaming goes, I've had a bunch of games on the go. I don't want to say which ones necessarily I'm reviewing because some might come out earlier than others, even though, sometimes you get a game for review that's going to take like 40 hours to beat. Then a week later, you get a game for review that's only going to take an hour. So you end up reviewing them out of order. So I'm not sure which ones are coming out just yet.
It's tough to stay on top of gameplay times. It's so unpredictable sometimes. So a game will give you, say, oh, well, it's got a 20-hour campaign, but you stop and smell the roses, and all of a sudden you're playing it for a week.
And
this is not done yet.
That's sort of the boat I'm in right now. I've got a few, like I said, on the go there. As far and movies wise, I'm still waiting on some stuff to come in. I watched a movie called Aniara, which is a Swedish science fiction futuristic movie where you're on a spaceship. Think of it like an entire city floating in space, and they run out of fuel, and then they have to figure out, how are they going to survive. It was a very interesting premise. I'll go in a little more detail in my review of it, but it's not just because it's a European film and it was subtitled that it seemed long-winded. It felt like the 2-hour movie felt like a 4-hour movie, if that gives you any idea. Very cool ideas, not necessarily very well executed.
It's good to see some interesting new plot points, though, instead of being something typical. Oh, we're in space.
Well, yeah,
the challenge is that we came across an alien race or some sort of bug people. No, it's a survival story based on your own internal elements. I like that.
Yeah, it's more like, okay, we have the ship produces algae, which then produces all the air for the ship. And, they have food that can be recycled. There's ways, they figure out ways, okay, we can eat some of the algae and then also use it to replenish our air supply. So they have a sustainable environment, but eventually will you go stir crazy sort of thing? Like, even though you've got this place that's the size of, like, what if you took 2 shopping malls and stacked them on top of each other? Okay. It's one of those. It's like the picture maybe the size of like the Enterprise, but a flat shopping mall. That's sort of the design of the ship. And it's like you're going on a 2-week cruise to Mars, and now you're going to be stuck for, let's say, 10 years or more. What do you do? So you didn't bring anything with you except like your bathing suit and a bunch of other stuff, and you're sort of just expecting, luxury, and then you're stuck in survival mode. So it was a cool idea again, and I'll go into more detail afterwards, but like I've been getting some weird stuff like that to review, which is kind of fun, and that was a pre-screener link, so I don't believe it's available anywhere else in North America yet, so I have to double check on the release schedule, and I'll put that in my review later on. As far as anything else goes, I've sort of just taken a week off mostly just to decompress because I've had so many reviews in the last month or two that I just wanted to take a week off, and then I know Birdman was gonna go he was going hard with all of his reviews instead.
And of course the looming illness that's been kind of plaguing our show for quite some time has been affecting you a bit lately, so you're kind of recovering from that as well, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, I felt like last weekend I was death. I was like freezing, shivering. I had the flu. And it came out of nowhere, and then it took me like 4 days to get the energy back, just to like a level where I felt like a human again. It felt like normal to actually get up and walk around. When you get that haze when you're like you're awake, you're walking around, but it's like you're looking and you're like, why isn't everything clear? That was my brain for like a week.
Well, it's good to have you back in the realm of the living. We're going to move on with the show. We're going to get to the news in just a moment. We will be back shortly. We'll get to talking about what's been happening around the world in This Week in Geek. Stay tuned.
Basically, use a geek,
sir. Leave me alone, geek boy.
Holy shit, you geeks are badass.
Valley originally released back in 2016 and has now been ported to the Nintendo Switch, joining the ever-expanding library of affordable Nintendo Switch indie titles. Valley sets you on a journey to obtain the fabled Life Seed, an object of incredible earth-changing power which archaeologists have been searching far and wide to obtain. You are on the hunt for this relic, and you've made your way to the Canadian Rockies where you hope to be the one to find it and become the most famous archaeologist of all time. One canoeing accident later, you find yourself lost, but you've also found your way to the Valley, a place of nature and balance, and it seems a likely place to find the life seed. You find a leaf suit, which stands for Leap Effortlessly Through Air Functionality. Admittedly, not the best acronym I've ever heard of, but it works well enough. The suit allows you to perform acrobatic stunts far beyond any human capacity, leaping through the air and dashing across water, amongst other feats of superhuman ability. You are also somehow connected to the Valley. You have the power to take and give life, though doing so can change the important balance of the Valley, and should the Valley fall out of balance completely, as an actual health bar indicates, it'll be game over, so don't use your powers lightly. Many games with a setting like this are labeled as walking simulators, and while some parts of this game follow suit, it's much more than that. It's fast-paced, with you flinging yourself across the gorgeous terrain and using your powers to kill or resurrect plants and animals along the way. There's action akin to some shooters, through the use of your powers, although it's not a twitch shooter by any stretch of the imagination. You do feel the connection to the Valley that the game implies you have, and dying is a quick way to deplete that all-important balance, as it will reduce the remaining health of the Valley, and you'll have to bring life back to the wildlife that's died thanks to your actions, if you want to keep going through the story. Valley is a good-looking game, for the most part. If you look at some textures up close, it can get a little rough at times, but most of the time, you're moving much too quickly to really notice small details, so most of your attention will be paid to the incredible landscapes with a varied and well-used color palette. I'm reminded somewhat of the best parts of Skyrim, with its sprawling fields and lush vegetation. The visual effects give your powers oomph, as the bright particle effects shimmer and glow as you take and give life to the environment around you. It's a world you can lose yourself in easily, just by taking a moment to look around. There was more than one moment that I found myself saying, wow, as I flung myself across the world. The audio is decent, though sometimes the sound effects can get a little repetitive, especially when stringing together a bunch of the same action, like jumping, but this is a minor nuisance and doesn't take away from the overall experience. The story is largely told through audio logs that you find throughout the world, and they all have a fitting tape recorder level of sound quality. I encourage you to try to find as many of these as you can, as skipping too many can make some of the later logs a bit confusing without enough context. All the more reason to play through again, though. The game is quite short, with a campaign that runs only about 4 or 5 hours, and even less should you try to blitz your way through the game. It feels like it could be the first chapter of a much larger game, but in today's gaming scene, I value quality over quantity, and the quality of gameplay is certainly present here. Valley is an exciting experience, sending you leaping through gorgeous terrain and overcoming obstacles with your mysterious and intriguing abilities. It may be short, but the time you spend playing will be rewarding, and you'll be glad you played. I definitely recommend Valley for anyone looking for a slightly different sort of adventure game. Until the next review, I'm Mr. Tristopher for ThisWeekInGeek.net.
Need a new weapon in your battle against evil? Check out LibrisArcana.com for Canada's premier RPG dice subscription service for only $7.97 Canadian with free shipping. You can get a new complete set of role-playing dice from D4s to D20s delivered straight to your door. Dice themes are new each month and can be anything your mind can imagine and beyond. Visit LibrisArcana.com and subscribe for only $7.97 Canadian with free shipping and be prepared to open up new worlds of adventure.
News on the march!
Here at This Week in Geek, we talk about things that have happened this week in Geek. Go figure. So this week, YouTube is our number one story, and YouTube has decided that they are going to be canceling a lot of their original programming. Original programming is something you find pretty much everywhere now. Amazon has their originals that are coming soon, including Lord of the Rings, which they're spending an obscene amount of money on. Netflix originals, of course, are probably the first thing you think of when you think of original programming on a streaming service. But YouTube has decided they're pulling their horse out of that race. They'll be canceling some shows such as Origin and Overthinking with Cat and June, neither of which I have ever heard of, to be quite honest.
Origin was a sci-fi. They've had some, and they say they're high budget. They're not that high budget. They're just anything that's going to require special effects, I think, is what they're pulling.
Yeah, it's a lot of the CGI and the really fancy effects that are going to cost them a lot of money. They're going to pull back on that.
Because what they showed was like the comedy drama stuff, like Cobra Kai, made them a lot of money without having to spend a ton on special effects.
Well, with Cobra Kai, you're basing a show on a lot of nostalgia. It's not necessarily a new concept, but if it has a popularity behind it already, then you have a recipe for success if you do it well. And it looks like they've been doing it well. Looks like it's set for a third season now.
Yeah, exactly. It hasn't even premiered the second season, and they're already gearing in because they know it's already going to be a hit for them based on the first one. Like, it was watched, the first season was watched more than any other show that they had combined. So, of course, they're going to cancel the ones that cost more than it.
So YouTube Premium is how people have been accessing a lot of this stuff, and it looks like they're going to be moving that from the premium service to be available for free to all users. Maybe not everything, but a lot of these popular original series will be available for free. So more people might get to see these programs, and I believe YouTube wants to move more towards an ad-based revenue service and model for these programs to fund them, which is kind of more in line with what YouTube is as a whole. The premium model for YouTube just might not be working as they planned, and they want to make it more in line with everything else YouTube is, which is watch some advertisement and the advertisers send money to the platform.
Yeah, and that won't affect people like myself. Like, I'm on a YouTube premium family plan because my brother works there. So in my case, I haven't had ads for about a year. That won't affect anybody there. It just means that like they'll have ads that are inserted, you know, when you're watching the premium stuff, or maybe they'll even have, it might even be a separate stream, like, because people that have ad blockers, it'll block things, right? And then you just have this sort of long pause while you wait between segments. They might do something where people they burn the ads directly into the video so you can't skip it, you know what I mean, as instead of a separate thing.
Yeah.
Which would stop people that use ad blockers. They would ensure that they have ads that are watchable. And then in the case of people that are YouTube Premium, they would just watch a separate stream that doesn't have the ads.
And there's also conventional methods of inserting advertising in more subtle ways, like product placement. I can see that making a bit more of a rise in YouTube content, where a sponsor will have their actual products displayed in the content itself instead of being a separate advertisement. Like the main character is drinking a can of Coca-Cola, for example. They'll very carefully show the Coca-Cola label on the can, or it'll be on a truck that's parked outside the main scene. So those are ways where advertisers can get their products and their services advertised without having to put a 30-second ad at the beginning of the program that people either won't pay attention to or have the ad blockers there to stop them altogether. So there's other ways to get the ad money coming through. As for YouTube as a whole, I'd like to see a lot of the money that they'd be putting into those original shows put back into both a user and content creator experience. There's a lot of problems that YouTube has right now for creators and for the people that want to support those creators. One of the main things being copyright claims and the system that's based around those. It's pretty much automated, where if someone puts a copyright claim against a video, even for a very popular content creator, they can have the revenue completely stopped from that video. And it takes a few days for that process to be repealed. It has to go through a lot of human channels just to get those things taken off of the account. But anyone who is a YouTube content creator that needs that for their way of life, the first few days of putting out a YouTube video are the most amount of views you're going to get. And if you don't have ads on that video and that's what you rely on for most of your income through YouTube, then all of a sudden this copyright claim is going to be a major problem. So I'd like to see YouTube improve that system and put a lot more funding and resources into making things easier for content creators that are essentially making these things not necessarily for free, but they're doing them out of passion instead of saying, okay, well, you're going to pay me $50,000 now for me to make this over the next year. They're making the content, whether or not they're making that $50,000, and hopefully making money off of that based off of advertising. But if you're taking the advertising out because of the flawed system, then there becomes a real problem and people want to see change. This is an opportunity for YouTube to reallocate those resources.
Very, very true. And you know, it's interesting that they're going in this route of, it's not that they're canceled. People always say, oh, YouTube cancels and Google cancels everything they do. They're just sort of restructuring things around that make more sense. Like, this is going to make them more competitive against people like Amazon Prime Video, where, you know, you have to pay to watch any of their content. And interestingly enough, out of maybe like four shows are actually watched by people that they produce. Like, they have the, I think it's Top Gear, the reimagining of Top Gear, the Grand Tour. They have American Gods. Is Handmaid's Tale there? No, that's Hulu, isn't it?
I'm not even really sure. But really, they've got
other than American Gods, they've got like maybe three shows that people actually watch, and they have all this content. And I have a subscription because I have, you know, my Prime account. But the difference between Amazon and Google and like YouTube is, yes, you're paying for, you know, no ads and that, but not that many people are actually subscribed to the premium service there. Whereas with Amazon Prime, they could spend, you know, billions of dollars, as is the case with the, you know, the Lord of the Rings. They're spending $1 billion to make a TV show, to make like one season. Like it's an insane amount of money, but they also are the biggest storefront in the world. They never lose money. It's being funded by the richest person on the planet. So, you know, they can afford to just keep dumping money in, even if people aren't going to watch it. Whereas Google's spread a little thinner. You know, they're launching Stadia and all this sort of stuff that, you know, they're spreading their tentacles far and wide, and that means that they're going to have to find new ways to get revenue.
And Google likes to experiment with a lot of things, and that costs money to do so. So Google Plus was a failed experiment, but they're also willing to pull the plug when things aren't working. But I think one of the major things to consider when comparing YouTube to Netflix and Amazon is what the companies look like as a whole from the consumer's point of view. When you're subscribing to Netflix, you're subscribing not necessarily for the originals. You want to watch dozens of movies in a month, or you want to watch whatever programs are available all the time. You think of Netflix, you think of basically the replacement for rental services as a whole. And those originals have just kind of cropped up organically and have become part of that programming. But you're paying $12 a month just to watch whatever you want. With Amazon, Amazon Prime is much more than just a streaming service. You get all the other benefits that Amazon Prime has. You have your free shipping. You have Twitch Prime benefits. There's so much more to that package.
Well, they've cut back a fair amount. There's no more discounts on pre-order games or anything. That was a big reason people subscribed. And they're actually cutting a lot of the benefits. So I don't know. Like, I'm a Prime member because I want the shipping. The fact that I get TV shows with it, great. But yeah, it's literally because of the shipping.
Yeah, it's a benefit. The Amazon Prime isn't the reason that you're the television programs, the programming isn't why you get Amazon Prime for the most part. You get it for other reasons, and it's just part of the package. With YouTube Premium isn't something people think of necessarily when they think of YouTube. YouTube is created as programming by the people for the people, I suppose. It's kind of something where creators that can be everybody or anybody anywhere can make something that ends up popular. It's about individual people. It's not about high production value necessarily. It's not about big budgets. It's about people making videos about what's happening in their own home or what's happening on the streets around them. So people don't consider YouTube as a streaming platform for hit shows. It's all about the individuals. It's all about the small stuff.
What it is it's public access television if the station decided to actually produce a few things themselves as well.
But it's not what people would go to public access television to expect. It's not what people are there necessarily to
be. But it would be like, what if I was flipping to public access television and surprisingly The Sopranos was being produced by them? You'd be like, what? And I think that's sort of what people have had. Like, the only breakout success, they've had like 10 different shows they produced. And a lot of them originally were going to be with partners that were, you know, people that started from nowhere and they became popular YouTubers. And those shows don't really sell, because they can watch their normal content anyway. The only breakout surprise success was Cobra Kai. And I think they're probably going to go down that route. You're probably going to see a lot more nostalgia sort of based shows.
That is if Disney and all them don't gobble up all the nostalgia that people have to offer right now.
True.
Moving on in our news this week, away from YouTube and into one of our favorite realms, Dungeons & Dragons. It's been revealed that Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello is a D&D DM. He's already a known geek who likes things like Star Trek, so people already know he's got certain tastes. But he put out a tweet recently saying the neighborhood kids needed a dungeon master to start a Dungeons and Dragons campaign. One man raised his hand. Hashtag community service. So Tom Morello is a DM. He's DMing for kids, and that's great. I think a lot of kids need a good DM that has a strong personality that's able to give them a good experience for D&D so that they can become a better player or be inspired to become DMs themselves, because the world needs more DMs. Just flat out, there aren't enough out there.
True, but you realize this is going to be the most politically charged Dungeons and Dragons campaign ever.
Of course.
Like, these kids are all going to be they're going to be going around the taverns passing around flyers, you know, down with the government.
Upset the system is every campaign. Just everything is always about overthrowing the government or overthrowing whatever power is there. It's a little themed.
Here's a question, you know, has an entire party of bards ever taken down the government before? Because that would be the game where it happens.
I would love to see that. I'd love to see a show made from Tom Morello DMing, because there's already a lot of popular shows now. D&D's never been as popular as it is now, and we have things like Critical Role to thank for that. So why not get Tom to produce a show, or get Tom on a show where he DMs, and bring it into a kind of an overlap between the musical genre and a D&D campaign. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, me too. Like, it's interesting that he had people in the past, like, I guess the first prominent person to come out as being a huge D&D player was probably Vin Diesel, like, as far as somebody you wouldn't expect.
Yeah, Vin Diesel, he says he's a huge nerd, and he's been playing D&D for a very long time, and since then, more and more people have kind of come out, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah, Joe Magnoliano is apparently huge. Like, all these guys that are like these like action star jock guys, turns out they were super duper nerds as kids.
Terry Crews is a big one as well. And you end up with a lot of these people actually guest starring on other programming, like Geek and Sundry has Dean Diesel with Vin Diesel. Celebrity D&D, well, apparently.
The Last Witch Hunter was basically a way for him to play one of his characters on screen.
And that's exactly what I think a lot of D&D needs, is more outlets and venues for people to roleplay. Because that's something that D&D is based around, of course. It's a role-playing game. But it's one of the aspects that I think a lot of people struggle with. So if they're able to consume more content, if they can watch videos and listen to podcasts, of people role playing and learn how to role play better, that can improve everyone's experience at the table and bring more people into playing the game, because all of a sudden it's not weird to role play, it's becoming more and more typical of an experience at a tabletop gaming session.
Oh, absolutely.
And instead of it just being about math and rules, it's about the cinematic experience. And
actors would be into it.
Yeah. You'd think it would be something that maybe they'd even do as part of their training to become an actor.
Like you workshop it or something. Just, you know, it's like one day a week after you're done your actor's workshop, you get together and you play, because that's a great way to do, you know, on your feet improv.
And you and I are part of a podcast at Terrible Warriors with the Cambridge Chronicles, with, of course, our DM, Mike the Birdman Dodd. And our sessions are more about the role playing than they are about the hard number crunching and the rules. So we try to focus more on the role playing aspect than anything else. And so seeing this happening out there is kind of a nice mirror for what we want to do. And it gives us a lot more tools to improve our own play and improve the things that we're able to deliver to the people that want to listen to us play that game as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So, Dungeons and Dragons is kind of a theme of today's news. A second story for D&D has to do with a movie that's been in the works for some time now. And no, oh, not boy. The D&D movie from 2000. That one was...
Or the sequel that people summary, forget not good.
Apparently there was two sequels. There was two...
Directed two sequels?
Movies. Direct-to-DVD didn't do well. The original D&D movie, not the original, actually, that's not true. There was one in 1983, I believe. But the 2000 movie that people think of when they think of Dungeons & Dragons, the movie, starred Justin Whalen and Jeremy Irons, one of my favorite people in the world, just saying. It grossed $33 million, but had a budget of $45 million. And if you go to Metacritic, it has a wonderful score of 14 because everybody just loved that movie.
I watched it for the first time last year, like fully from beginning to end. And I couldn't believe that it was like it. The special effects are worse than the Super Mario Brothers movie that came out like 7 or 8 years earlier.
It's so true. It was awful. I liked the movie, but I like a lot of terrible movies. It's just the way I am. But this new movie is it's been slated to come out in summer of 2021, but we don't really know for sure because there haven't been too many updates. The most recent updates being that there is a new script because apparently the old one was no good. And casting is supposed to be beginning soon, and they're after some A-list actors for it. So that might lend some credibility and some sort of...
It depends on potential. The A-list actor.
Yeah, some of the names they've been throwing around, and I'm assuming this is just, wouldn't it be nice if, more than they're actually approaching these people, Will Smith, Josh Brolin, Chris Pratt, Vin Diesel. There's Vin Diesel. That would actually work fairly well because he's already a big D&D fan. So
Vin Diesel, Will Smith will ruin it. I'm sorry. I don't know if I can see. His movies have been bad the last like 10 years.
We're waiting on Aladdin to see how that goes, but I don't have high hopes for that. Some other names, Matthew McConaughey, Dave Bautista, Jeremy Renner, and of course, Johnny Depp.
Matthew McConaughey as a dwarf. That would be great.
Right. So at the moment, the movie has no director, but they are also in search for a new director. The movie was confirmed last year in April, so it's been about a year since anyone's heard anything about this movie. But I think it has some potential to be a good little cult classic, but I really don't see it being a mainstream big movie where everyone goes, yeah, I love the D&D movie. It'll be more of a, hey, let's go watch the D&D movie and have a good chuckle.
Well, right now, I can tell you, they're not going to go the Lord of the Rings route. They're not going to get like a Peter Jackson because they wouldn't want it to have confusion between those properties. If you're smart, you can't go super dark with it because they want it to be open to families. You also can't go like super beyond campy. You know, give it to somebody like what's his name, like Gore Verbinski, the guy that did the Pirates movies.
Yeah, I think that could do it well, where it's approachable but also has its heavy moments. That
or one of the Harry Potter directors, one of the earlier Harry Potter directors, not one of the ones.
Not the grim, dark, everything has a gray filter on it style.
Or health. This is, you know, you want to give something to somebody who would do it justice. Give it to somebody like, oh, why am I drawing a blank on his name? Oh my God, he's such a great director. Pacific Rim, Hellboy 1 and 2, or Hellboy 2, won the Oscar for the fish sex movie.
Pacific Rim director Guillermo del Toro.
Yes, give it to him. He makes crazy fantasy stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on the tone of the film and the actual plot itself. That's something you got to be
terrible.
Oh God, please no. I think one of the things that makes D&D hard to make a movie out of is how fluid and ever-changing the plot really is. Every D&D campaign is different than every other campaign you've ever played because there's so much player agency. You're playing the game. You get to make decisions that you only would make. There are big strokes of the story that are kind of set in these different campaigns that have been written over the years. But which one do you choose? How do you tell that story? And how do you insert the player characters into this story in a way
I feel like they'll have to set it in Ravenloft. Setting it in one of the other realms, the issue is they're too similar to like Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones then.
They're very pure high fantasy. D&D is based around high fantasy, and then the details just comes down to the individual DM. So you need to have a
like Ravenloft is an interesting setting. Set it there, or set it I don't know where else you could really do it, where you have to make it set itself out from like appearing like everything else. Because could D&D like what can do D&D better than like Game of Thrones did?
Yeah, it's already a genre that's been thoroughly explored over the last decade or so. So what new ground can you break? And
yeah, like the first movie came out clearly as a cash grab because the Lord of the Rings was in production. and they thought, we can come up with this first. And then Lord of the Rings comes out, and it's like a million times better.
Yeah, and there's always the chance it's going to come out more like The Hobbit as well, instead of Lord of the Rings, where you got this epic, you end up with The Hobbit, where it's trying too hard in all the wrong ways and just ends up kind of flopping because they take a small amount of material and stretch it too long. Are you going to try to make a D&D trilogy, or are you just going to try to make it a nice brief adventure? Because it's something that you could almost make a series out of it instead.
It could end up being like the Neverending Story, where you have a really good first movie and then each subsequent film gets shittier and shittier and shittier.
I could really see that happening. If the first one succeeds, then we'll end up with more, and that might be more harm than good. So that'll wrap up this week's news, as I try not to choke to death. I had to cut off my mic for a second because, oh my God, ow. Anyway, we're going to take a little break. We're going to go to some other stuff that you get to listen to our wonderful voices. And then we're going to come back a little bit later with the weird, the wacky, the just plain fucked up here on ThisWeekInGeek.net, the flagship of stupidity.
Those magnificent bastards!
Color me kooky, but something very odd is going on around here.
You're not allowed to talk anymore.
We are looking at the PDP Level 50 Wireless Xbox One headset from PDP Gaming. This is a fantastic wireless headset that I've had the pleasure of testing out over the last few weeks here in the Twig Studios. This thing features a 50 millimeter high definition audio drivers, and they do sound really, really fantastic. I've actually been playing this with several games that are highly dependent upon sound. I've actually been playing this with the Division 2, which is wonderful since I use a lot of the sound cues to hunt in the environment, because a lot of the enemies like to call out, reloading, changing position, and all that sort of bullshit. I also find these to be extremely comfortable. I actually own a pair of Astro A40s and A30s. And dare I say, for a mid-range headset, this is actually about as comfortable as those. And I didn't think I'd actually get that level of comfort without spending a couple of $100. Which is kind of nice. One of the things I do like about this microphone too, I actually have a Logitech headset for my PC that does this. When you bring down the boom microphone, when you push it up into its upright position, it mutes the mic. So you don't have to fool around with anything on your controller. I mean, you can if you want to, but you can do that too. There's also a chat mixer, which is exclusive to the Xbox One version, where you can turn down the game sound, or you can increase your chat session, or you can do the opposite of that if you want to. The biggest test for me, though, was bringing this into a game that is purely dependent upon sound. What am I talking about? Rock Band 4. And I use this like a singing headset. Now, when the songs require you to hit the microphone, that doesn't work so well. So that if there was a fault of this mic, it may be that. But when you're actually singing things like, say, Green Day or 3 Days Grace or Godsmack or any number of the different bands that are featured in the game's DLC, you can really hit the notes with this, and the mic is able to pick it up too. So if you really want to blast out some of the Queen songs, I think you can do that as well. I gotta say, PDP Gaming has really done a fantastic job with this microphone setup that makes it accessible. I like the fact that it turns off when you take up the boom arm. The chat mixer is a very nice touch, especially even now that you don't have to fool with actual settings in game anymore. And the fact that I have a wireless microphone for Rock Band, that definitely gets a recommend from me. So check out the Level 50 Xbox One wireless headset from PDP/PDP Gaming.
PDP Gaming was kind enough to send me a Level 50 wired Xbox gaming headset to try. So try it I did, and I gotta say, I'm definitely going to be using this one going into the future. Of course, for most people, the most important part about a headset is the audio, and the Level 50 certainly delivers on this, with its rich, deep sound that lets you immerse yourself in the game you're playing and minimizes distractions that real life can bring. It's not quite a 10 out of 10 for clarity, but the audio has plenty of range, and the volume is just right. If the volume's not quite right, you can easily adjust it with a dial on the right headphone, so adjusting is at your fingertips at any time. Comfort is almost as important as audio for a headset. And once again, PDP provides a quality product that will keep your ears comfortable, even in an hours-long play session. The padded ear cups are soft but firm enough to provide functional padding, and the headset stays firmly in place on your head. The headband is adjustable, allowing all head shapes and sizes a comfortable fit. The headset's also nice and light, so once you're used to wearing it, you'll barely notice it's even there. The microphone is decent quality, and about as good as you can expect from a headset mic. It doesn't quite set itself apart, but your friends and teammates will be able to hear you loud and clear, so it gets the job done. I wouldn't use this for streaming or YouTube, though. My favorite feature of the PDP Level 50 headset is its versatility. It may have been designed for the Xbox One, but I find myself using it for my Nintendo Switch and even my cell phone. The cord isn't long, but it's plenty long enough to use with any handheld device you own with a headphone jack on it. The PDP Level 50 provides a well-priced solution for your gaming audio needs. It comes in both wireless and wired versions, and I highly recommend giving these a try if you're looking for a decent headset on a modest budget. Until the next review, I'm Mr. Christopher for ThisWeekInGeek.net.
What makes you qualified to be a reporter?
I'm willing to violate anyone's privacy for my personal gain and then claim with a straight face that the public has a right to know.
By the hand of Zeus, what manner of deviltry is this?
I love fake alien poop day.
Welcome back to ThisWeekInGeek.net. Now it is time for the weird news, the wacky news, the what the hell are we talking about news. This week in the strange, we're going to start with MySpace, which is a little site you may have heard of if you are old enough to have remembered it. It is what came before Facebook and has turned essentially into just a music sharing site. So there's not really much like Facebook anymore. The problem is, a few years ago, they made a server transfer and something went wrong and about 12 years worth of music and content was corrupted and deleted from the site.
And that's not just one person. That's anybody that had music on there. 12 years worth is gone.
So not absolutely every single song is gone, but for the most part, if anything from more than 3 years ago was uploaded to the site, it is probably corrupted, it's probably gone, and there's no way to recover it. So they apparently put out a warning sometime in July of last year saying, as a result of a server migration project, any photos, videos, and audio files you uploaded more than 3 years ago may no longer be available on or from MySpace. We apologize for the inconvenience and suggest you retain your backup copies. That was posted in July of last year, and nobody seems to have noticed until about last week. So that tells you how much MySpace is still being used by the general public.
It took that long for any news article to pop up.
I have to wonder if my old MySpace page still has any music playing on it. I don't remember what I used to play.
I never had one because I was too young to really like I had an ICQ number, but I didn't have a MySpace account because people like things like free webs and all the like where you get 20 megabytes of your own web space. That stuff was popping up. So I was making my own blogs on my own website. I wasn't using like LiveJournal or MySpace, and I found that the people that use MySpace, it was mostly for people that were like super emo.
It seemed to be a very much angst filled place for high schoolers that really wanted to express their individuality and no, it's not just a phase, mom.
And for girls that loved those emo bands
and all the big scene hair, that was I think where the first place I saw scene hair appear was on MySpace. everyone was in a competition with everyone else to get into the top 8 spaces on your MySpace profile. It was a major popularity contest. Everybody loved Tom, and it was a great time until Facebook came along and changed everything, and everyone migrated over there and left MySpace in the dust. Although
MySpace went, why?
The person who sold MySpace, I actually can't remember the name of the person who owned it, is sitting pretty. He sold it for a lot of money, so they're not exactly upset.
Sold the right time. And also, like, the site basically became just for like your indie garage bands to promote themselves.
And that's part of the problem with all of this being deleted, is there's a lot of bands out there that may have only had their music available on MySpace. They didn't have another outlet for it. They might not have hard copies of their music stored on their own devices. Here in the digital age, where everything's on the internet and not necessarily on a hard copy, something like data corruption can ruin a lot of things and erase a lot of history. So hopefully they have some backups.
Maybe there's a band that one or two members ended up forming a more famous band later on. Well, they might have only put out a demo. And, you know, if those demo, you know, if it had been the early 2000s, they would have been on literally a demo cassette or a demo CD probably. And if they're gone, and let's say they lost the physical copy, there's maybe nothing left, like you said, at all. And the only way to have listened to it, like, unless somebody went and, you know, found a way to record or download what was on their MySpace site and then re-upload it to YouTube, there's pretty much no way to recover it.
That's a pretty big hit to the overall culture that MySpace could provide. There's a lot of cultural history there. Like you said, with some people that may have gone on to become bigger and better and more famous, their early work is now completely gone. And that could be a source
of people that were lost in the shuffle, like, you know, the post Napster, you know, they didn't know where to go. They weren't on like CD Baby or any of the sites that were for indie sites. Like, they might have just had their start there and then they folded. Well, it's the kind of band where maybe they don't exist anymore. They only existed for like a year's worth of time, but they had something brilliant that the record labels didn't pick up on because they were ahead of their time. Well, now they might never be able to get picked up on, like, if there's nothing there.
I have to wonder what kind of infrastructure is needed to avoid something like that happening. Like, can you imagine a similar thing happening to YouTube, for example? If something were to happen to the data that's available on YouTube, like, I don't know how they store their information.
Basically, YouTube and Google, when they announced their Stadia stuff this past week, they kind of pulled the curtain back and revealed that they have a second internet. So where all their servers are on the net, you know, they're all connected to the broader internet. They also have been installing a separate internet that they own themselves. So they have redundancy on thousands upon thousands of servers on the internet. So one goes down, there's like 10,000 other servers that have the same data. So unless all the data goes out all at once, those servers are fine. Well, even if it does, they then have their own internal internet that isn't connected to the broader internet that has backups of all of their own data. So the answer is billions of backups. Like, if you're not going to have, like, and
how
that's
much
really,
does that cost them? Because there's a lot of information that's going into YouTube at all times, millions of
hours. They're
also
working with companies like that, are working with data centers and companies that make the actual physical media to back up onto. And they're working with them, you know, night and day to, you know, create newer, more resilient technologies that will, you know, stand through weather, through electrical pulses, all that sort of crap. And then there's the old fashioned, you know, thing. Google, I guarantee you, has data backups on tape. So it's one of those things where MySpace was in the infancy of not the internet. The internet had been around, you know, easily 10 years or more before that, but it was in the infancy of like the general public using media to share across the internet. So it sounds like all of their stuff was stored on one server farm and they had no redundancy anywhere else. And, you know, being, you know, in their migration, they just didn't think it through and moved whatever data they could. They probably moved all the data that was like small, anything under a certain amount of size. So my guess is anything under like 3 megabytes probably got transferred, and anything over that size, they just truncated and said, we don't need the data. Well, that's where all the media would be.
It's kind of scary that there's only there's no redundancies in a site like MySpace, because MySpace is, might not be popular anymore, but it's still used and it's still a music sharing site, so it has its purposes. But you'd think they'd have some sort of redundancy.
When it was at its peak, it probably did, and they started scaling down and scaling down and scaling down to the point where they only had one server farm. And then they're like, oh, we're going to move to a... What they probably did was they moved to a scalable server farm sort of through like Amazon or Microsoft or Google's scalable, you know, internet cloud backup service, rather than have their own physical server farm that they had. And then they just wanted to cheap out and not pay for moving the extra data. And then they went, well, fuck, almost all of our data is now gone because we're stupid. So that's what happens when, you know, you don't have somebody in IT that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I guess the lesson here is backups, backups, and more backups. If you have anything, I mean,
we went through the same thing at Birdman had the same issue. He had some of his you know, work and sensitive data was on a backup drive, but that backup drive was the only backup, and then his drive went, and that was like 2 months ago, and I had to help him try to recover what we could. And then now he's set up in such a way that anything sensitive gets backed up to his own personal cloud data that's on a portable drive that is hooked up through his net. And then from there, it also gets backed up into the Google Cloud. So now he's got 2 points of extra backup. And it ends up costing money. It costs a couple $100 to get set up like that. But, you know, what's a couple $100 for when you have no other means to back up your stuff? Like,
yeah, and saving 10 years worth, or 12 years in this case, worth of data, just for this, the cost of a couple $100, that's pretty well exactly. worth it totally on worth a personal it. Level.
And I mean, that's just on a personal scale, so you can imagine that it was a lot more on the MySpace scale, but where their money lied in whatever accounts were still active on there, and who's going to keep an account active now when half their data's gone?
Well, speaking of data and other problems with the internet, our next story has to do with PewDiePie and all of his wonderful fan base. Well, I'm sure a lot of them are just fine. Out of 91 million and change people, there's got to be some good ones in there.
Out of 91 million people, if you know only 10 million of them are crazy racist, then that's okay, right?
Right. This is just a small percentage. But there's been a race going for the top YouTube channel in the world. The race has been between PewDiePie and T-Series, which is a kind of a content conglomerate, I guess. They take a whole bunch of videos from different places and put it all in one place. So they're curating content rather than making it themselves. So people have been trying different things to get people to subscribe to PewDiePie. The phrase subscribe to Pewds or subscribe to PewDiePie has been kind of tossed around the internet quite a bit in all of its various forms. As of right now, PewDiePie is sitting at 91,285,285 subscribers, and T-Series is just a little bit higher than that at 91,303,000 and some change. I have a live feed that's constantly changing. It's very annoying to watch, so I'm going to turn it off. But there's the numbers right now. They're pretty much neck and neck. But PewDiePie fans have been trying different stunts to get more attention drawn to PewDiePie, to try to convince people to subscribe to his channel just so they can win this race that doesn't really get them anything. It's just for bragging rights. The latest trick has been developing ransomware, really crappy ransomware that infects computers and encrypts the data on those computers, holding it for ransom until PewDiePie reaches 100 million subscribers. The problem is, this homemade ransomware is really, really, really bad quality, and after encrypting the files, the original producers of this ransomware have forgotten or lost the original encryption keys, which means that the data is essentially lost forever.
Of course.
So, after realizing that they could get into a lot of trouble for doing this, the original creators of the ransomware have publicly released the code, so everyone who has been infected by the files can, or infected by the virus rather, can decrypt their own files and get their data back. But this goes to show that people will do some really weird things for really weird reasons and cause a lot of problems for no good reason.
Why do I feel it's a very 4chan thing that happened?
It does sound like a 4chan thing. I don't know exactly where it originated. But this kind of thing is not okay, people. Don't ruin other people's lives because you want,
especially since PewDiePie's a joke and his videos don't have any real value or content. it's just a bunch of screaming. That's all it is. Just let's scream and then occasionally say racist shit. If that's what's going to get me 100 million subscribers, I guess we should do that, right?
It's all the wrong content that we've been trying to create. We're barking up the wrong tree.
Vapid, you know, we have to have no vapid thoughts, nothing in our brains. Just scream at the screen like a little girl. Like the most ridiculous, stupid. I have tried to watch his videos. If you could say, I'm saying that in quotes, videos.
And it's content, all right?
It's just a bunch of garbage. Like, I would rather watch golfing programming than watch that. Like, and it's what they're not showing is like those other subscribers, how many of the people have less than a 100 IQ? Like, how many people in there are just dumb and need something on in the background? And I mean, if somebody likes PewDiePie's videos, you know, write into feedback at This Week in Geek and explain why you like it, because I just need to know how it is somebody likes his content.
Yeah, what is it about PewDiePie's videos that you like? Let us know for sure, because I'm confused as hell. I know
we just want to analyze it. Like, we're not calling you dumb or anything. It's just I'm infuriated and frustrated at that is the content that's getting 100 million subs.
Yeah, these promoted YouTubers tend to have a very immature style, and it's working for them. I'm not hating on them as a person necessarily. They're doing what it means to be successful, like what they need to do to maintain their success and their fan base. So I understand their reasons for putting out the content, but why is that content successful in the first place? What is the draw? What's the appeal?
They're putting down their audience, like they're talking down at them, because it's like, my audience is stupid, so I'm only going to create stupid content for stupid people. And that's just the feeling I get from them. And then when they say something racist and all this sort of stuff, they're like, "Whoop!" They don't even. Well, I guess it was my bad, and they move on. No. That doesn't just slip out. Like, and it's happened multiple times, but it's apparently okay. Yet, if a smaller YouTuber made comments like that, they're crushed completely.
Yeah, they get their channel demonetized and deleted potentially, depending on the severity of it.
So,
but PewDiePie has made racist comments before.
Anti-Semitic. Yeah.
Yeah, you get away with it because you're popular and you're generating a lot of revenue for the website. And let's not forget that a lot of these YouTubers are also known as influencers, because they influence people. There's a reason that PewDiePie's fan base is also known as his 9-year-old army. There's a lot of children that watch these shows.
That's my thing. Is like, here's the thing. You want to, like, I, you know, me and my personality, you want to be in, you know, incisive and say a bunch of stuff that's going to piss people off, or you know, I can go and hang with the rest of them. I can go deeper and darker than PewDiePie probably ever would. The difference is, when I'm talking to people either on here or through Cambridge Chronicles, I think the vast majority of our listeners, I'm willing to bet about 99% of them are over 18, and they're adults. They can tell the difference between somebody, you know, being satirical and making jokes and being dark and edgy for the sake of being edgy. But a 9-year-old can't tell that. I'm sorry, no matter how smart and intelligent and advanced for their age they are, you're just not developed enough until you're 18, 19, 20. Hell, a lot of people in their mid-20s aren't even mature enough to really tell the difference. So I have an issue when he's playing for children and saying these things.
Yeah, it's, you need to have a certain sense of responsibility when you know that you're able to influence such a vast audience and an impressionable audience. So taking that personal responsibility of making sure your content is wholesome, like, it doesn't necessarily need to be kid friendly where you're Mr. Rogers essentially.
No,
but no, have
absolutely
some,
no gee golly, oh golly willikers, none of that crap. Just full on, you know, act like you would if the kids were in the room with you. And if that's how you're going to act when kids are in the room with you, you shouldn't be around children.
No, exactly. You know, you need to understand what your audience is and play to that audience. And I don't mean in a way that just makes it so they'll watch you more necessarily, but make it so that you're making a positive influence. You're being a positive force in that person's life and not goading them into becoming someone who has racist remarks because, oh, I heard it from a famous YouTuber, so it must be okay. And that's the way that children think. If an adult that they look up to says something or does something, they think that's how they should act too.
Exactly. And then you have on top of that's the ransomware and all this crap. Really, like, this that should be like a death nail in his subscriber count. People should be like, fuck this guy, and then just stop listening or watching him.
Yeah, I don't understand the reasoning behind, well, I'm just going to infect this person's computer and make it so their data is corrupted until another 9 million people around the world subscribe to this YouTuber for some reason.
For the lols, bro.
I don't understand that mentality. Like, yeah, some practical jokes are fun, but practical jokes mean having a little bit of fun at the expense of someone's embarrassment, not at the expense of their well-being or their means of income or their means of surviving, really. Some people make their living on the internet, and if you corrupt their data or you encrypt their data until some arbitrary thing happens, it's not even something where, okay, well, if I sub to PewDiePie, I get my stuff back. No, it's just until he reaches a certain number of subs, which is completely out of that person's control. That's not fair. It's not good in any way. But there's an extra layer of it not being fair because it's out of your control.
Absolutely.
So enough about frustrating YouTubers and on to other scary things and real world threats. Russia is planning a ground force of military robots because the world was not a scary enough place as it is now.
Do they run on potatoes and vodka?
I would imagine so. It's got to be a fuel source somewhere, and there's plenty of that in Russia to go around. So the military over in Russia is developing these combat-ready robots to assist infantry. They resemble miniature tanks, and they can be deployed alongside the infantry or with swarms of quadrotor drones, which can send targeting information back to the robot. Right now, the robot still needs to be controlled by a human to select targets or to remotely control the robot, but the Advanced Research Foundation says that the ultimate goal of these robots is to switch over to AI algorithms as soon as possible. Holy crap. That's that's terrifying.
Russia.
I don't want to live on this planet anymore because it's becoming more and more of a scary place to live. There's been a lot of calls for bans on automatic weapons around the world already, but the US, the UK, and Russia are all working on autonomous weapons as it is now, well, despite these pleas to say, don't do it.
What's going to happen here is people are like, oh, it's going to be a nuclear war. No, there's no point in firing nukes at these things. It'll be an EMP war where who takes out whose technology first.
Yeah, technology is becoming the entirety of combat, but there's a lot of ethical questions that start to come into it. Part of these protests against autonomous weapons have to do with a human making the decision to kill someone. Because if you put it on an AI algorithm, you end up with this dystopian future where all of a sudden profiling is done automatically and you decided whether or not you should survive based on factors that aren't necessarily ethical. They're just,
or the robots just go, fuck it, we're not going to kill you, the masters, either. We're just not going to kill anybody. We're just going to walk around and do whatever the hell we want, because
all of a sudden the settings change as AI. It's unpredictable.
They might just sit on the battlefield and be like, nah, we don't want to fight.
I know there was an experiment done with AI, basic AI, of course, because complex AI is still long beyond our capabilities, but some bots were written and given some basic AI functionality and put into the world of Counter-Strike. And the objective was to find the most efficient way to win a game of Counter-Strike. And after hundreds or thousands of iterations and rounds and simulations of these rounds going, they went back into the simulation to see what it was that the robots had come up with. And essentially, they weren't moving. All of the bots were just, they'd spawn in and they'd stand there. And the reasoning behind this was, if they were to move or act or do anything, they would end up potentially losing. So the best possible outcome was don't do anything. It'll end up a draw every time. So that was
somebody to show up and then shoot them sort of thing, or they just did nothing.
They did absolutely nothing. All of the bots would not move because ending in a draw was the mathematically best outcome. And what they then did was put a human player in there. And as soon as the human player were to move or take any actions, anything else that could shoot it would shoot it to stop that moving from happening, to retain that state of basically stasis.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of scary, but it plays right into your point of
before. They kill all the humans and then they just sit there in the fields.
Yeah, I can't lose if I don't play, essentially, is the where they ended up. It's kind of freaky. You have to wonder where AI is going to end up. in a combat role, and it's terrifying to think of, because humans, we have our faults, of course, and our prejudices, and the differences that we have in opinion, be them political or religious or whatever, have driven us to have wars and fight with each other all the time. But AI, I feel, isn't going to have that same motivation, because it's going to be based on logic, pure logic. And most logic says, you know, don't fight, because it's not good to fight. You could potentially lose. Animals even have a similar logic behind them. A lot of animals, bears and predatory animals, won't fight with each other because it reduces their chances of survival. So yeah, that's the
and they only really eat because they're hungry. Like, you know, I mean, they don't just kill everything around them when they don't have to. Some animals do, but for the most part, they don't.
But largely, the more intelligent predatory animals are adverse to fighting each other. They're adverse to threats because they just want to live. They'll eat what they need to eat, and then they'll avoid fighting things because they want to just survive and be as intact as possible. I feel like AI is going to follow a similar vein where it'll avoid combat rather than strategically find the right targets. No, it's just going to try its best to eliminate as little as possible to avoid that sort of combat.
Yeah, that makes sense, but it's also creepy as hell.
It is. You're going to end up with all these half-dormant AI robots of death sitting on battlefields everywhere around the world, and as soon as a human shows up to disrupt anything, they're all just going to turn and annihilate it, and that's scary. So kind of feels Terminator-ish. All that'll be left is robots, and all humans are going to die, but you know, we knew that already. That's been kind of the staple of anything. When you say AI, you just think robots will take over the world. That's the train of thought.
Russian robots.
It's always Russia, isn't it? Please don't kill me, Russia. I know I've talked about you before, but stop being weird. Really.
Just like, what do you have against everybody? Like, really, why do you hate everybody?
Just chill, Russia, chill. And I don't mean Russian winter chill. And that's another point, though. Can these robots survive the Russian winter?
They can survive the Russian winter. They can survive pretty much anything.
So they have the strongest testing grounds in the world just from environmental factors alone. So watch out, world. Russian robots are coming.
Yeah, if it can survive there and it can survive the Sahara, we're screwed.
The end is nigh, but the end is always nigh. And we talk about the end of the world quite often on this show. But try to think happy thoughts anyway. That's our fun.
Maybe they'll be just like fun, you know, robots. Who knows?
Fun bots. Well, there's probably a lot of fun style robots coming too, but most of those are out of Japan, I think. Anyway, that'll do it for this week's weird news. We'll come back to wrap up our show after some other content that we made. You can check that out right here in just a moment here on thisweekingeek.net.
This is a fair request, and I promise I will not judge any person only as a teenager, and that this is no more right than saying all teenagers are drunken dope addicts or glue sniffers.
We are looking at Creed 2 from Warner Brothers Home Entertainment on Blu-ray. Well, Creed 2, as the title suggests, this is the sequel to the first Creed movie, which ultimately I really, really, really liked. I like Michael B. Jordan. He was awesome in Black Panther. He was wicked in Creed. And he returns to his role as Adonis Creed, now the heavyweight champion of the world. But as you can guess, things are not always cheery in the land of Philadelphia and heavyweight boxing. Someone has decided to rear their ugly head after nearly 30-something years, and that's Ivan Drago and his son Victor, who've become kind of disgraced in Russia since their last bout in Rocky IV. So what happens in this is the story of Adonis basically learning how to be humble, but also coming to terms with his father's legacy, who he is, and why he gets in that ring. And Rocky himself, Sylvester Stallone, gives him some really solid advice during this movie. Basically, remember why you're going in that ring, why you fight. These three steps will seem like a mountain when you climb into them. Remember why you're here. And that's what I really liked about this movie. I really had a fantastic time with this. Dare I say, I like this a little bit better than the first, because the Rocky movies, as they describe them in the special features, are always the underdog story. There are the kind of movies that you can cheer for, and boxing movies typically have that going for them, but the Rocky movies are a different kind of pedigree that kind of set them apart from the other ones like Raging Bull and whatnot. And I really liked Michael B. Jordan's performance in this. I loved the girl, I can't remember the actress's name, sorry. She played Valkyrie in Thor Ragnarok as his fiance Bianca. Wonderful performance there. It's kind of cool to see Dolph Lundgren again taking on the Ivan Drago character, and the actor that plays Victor Drago is built like a brick shithouse. Jesus, he looks like he could take on the mountain from Game of Thrones. Movie, great. Special features, also pretty good. One of the special features that I really enjoyed the most was the Rocky Legacy, which is about 10 or 15 minutes, give or take, kind of exploring the legacy of Rocky all the way from Rocky 1 through Rocky Balboa and the first Creed movie and this one. And it's kind of cool just seeing how many people have really been taken by these movies, like professional boxers, how it's affected people like Sylvester Stallone himself, Dolph Lundgren. They also talk about the father's and son's legacy with Apollo Creed, who is Adonis's dad from the first movie, Sylvester Stallone, his son, and Ivan Drago and his son. And I don't know, just there's something about the Creed 2 movie that I really, really, really liked. And I think if you like Michael B. Jordan, if you like underdog stories, if you want to see some really well put together fight choreography, you're really going to get a kick out of this. The training montage in the desert is really awesome. And the final fight against Victor, especially when the music gets going, is really fantastic. So you should check out Creed 2 from Warner Brothers Home Entertainment.
Do you have any hobbies?
I collect spores, molds, and fungus.
Hold that thought. It's crapper time.
We're looking at Modiphius' latest addition to the Star Trek Adventures role-playing game, and that is Star Trek Adventures Science Division. And what this book adds is, well, gives you characters from the Science Division. That's medical, counseling, and just plain science officers. People like Spock, the holographic doctor, Dr. Beverly Crusher, Counselor Troy, etc., etc. And it really does add a lot of science-y type depth to your game, and does give you some other ideas for play, including stuff on the Q continuum, time travel, stuff like that. And I had a lot of fun reading through this book because it made me consider other possibilities for my games. One of the things that really stuck out to me in a really positive way is the book asks you at one point, should your ship have a ship's counselor? And then when I first read this section, I was like, well, yeah, that makes sense, to have someone relieve the stresses of space travel. But it asks you to consider it in a different way. If a character, say, experiences, say, a major trauma, and it uses the example of Kirk with the Klingons, how does he work through the trauma of that? Or, say, Tasha Yar and her upbringing. And I was thinking, wow, I never quite thought of it like that. So the game asks you, are you sure you want to include this character in your game? Because it can bring up uncomfortable feelings, especially if you want a more personal type game. Like, Tasha Yar had a very rough upbringing to the point where I'm not even comfortable saying the word on here. But if you follow the show's lore, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So it gives your characters the chance to have a more personal growth story as you go through it. But it also talks about things like the Q continuum, and gives you encounters for that as well. It also gives you ideas how to create new aliens. But you have to think about, well, what's the star like in their system? Like, how do you create something that makes sense in the logic of Star Trek? Another thing it does is gives you some major NPCs. Some of these I did not expect, such as Dr. Carol Marcus, Dr. Lewis Zimmerman, Dr. Noonien Soong, the guy that made Data, stuff like that. And just little things like that really flesh out this book, and I think really gives the all the Star Trek splat books that have been released to date a full value. Now you can have all these different characters on your crew, and you can have all these different experiences in your games, be they weird alien stuff from Supernova, Nova, Pulsars, Magnetars. They actually talk about stuff like that in this, and that got me really, really excited. The fact that nobody talks about this stuff, but I love Magnetars. They're a very dangerous type of star. In fact, you want to read something really scary? A wolf rayet star, and I can't remember. That's a Magnetar. It's dangerous. It's scary. It's bad. It's near us. Boom. We could die. Anyway, back to the book. No, this is seriously a really good addition. If you have Command, if you have Operations, then it makes sense that you should also have Sciences to round out your Star Trek Adventures experience. I cannot recommend this book enough, especially if you're a science geek or a nerd. If you're intent on playing a science type character, then this is definitely a book you want to add to your collection.
Welcome back to ThisWeekInGeek.net. This is the end of the show where we talk about a little bit of our lives, a little bit of what's coming up in the near future, although we're kind of at a place where we're without Mike, and without Mike, we have no idea what's going on, to be honest. We're just, you know, lemmings that follow our fearless leader even over a cliff, and that's what we do.
Yeah, and I know we've got stuff that we got to record and do. It's just a matter of, I don't know when. we're in a weird space where it's like, is everybody's health going to be back in order? Is the internet going to work?
Yeah, there's been little trip-ups.
Robots going to come kill us? Who knows?
Little things getting in the way, like an AI revolution or a little cold getting in the way of recording properly every single week. But we're hoping that next week things will be back to normal. It'll be all three of us in one place. Well, not necessarily in one place. We tend to record over the power of the internet. But all the same, we end up getting into your earbuds. Earbuds? Earbuds isn't a thing. Oh, yes, it is.
I like saying ear holes.
Ear holes. I like that, ear holes. But this week's show was, again, a departure from the norm. So we hope you enjoyed that. Coming up in the near future, I know I have some more reviews to do. I'm a little bit backlogged on some indie titles like Unit 4, Platformer. They call it a Souls-like in 2D. I'm not sure if I believe that necessarily, but it is definitely challenging. I also have the Book of Unwritten Tales, which will eventually come out. I swear it will. It's a good game. But right now I'm working on Sekiro Shadows Die Twice because that is a major focus for me right now. It's a challenging game, and I only have so many hours in a day to contribute to playing that because I share the TV with my wonderful fiance. So it's only fair that she gets to use the TV too. So that's me for the next little while, is trying to work on my reviews as always. How about you?
I'm in about the same boat. I got about probably 10, 12 things on the go. It's just a matter of, I'm going to have to sit down over the next day or two and just pound out all the reviews, because I've got stuff that I'm finished. I just haven't had the time to sit down and actually record. And now that I'm feeling mostly better, it's time to just have a recording day, you know, make a big batch of popcorn and be like, record, 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 record. Because people don't realize, like, to get a like 5-6 minute review, that's about 30 minutes of work per thing.
Yeah, so, it depends on how much editing you want to put into it. And writing a script can take some time, and then actually recording it. I'm the type that likes to write a script from beginning to end.
Yeah, I make point form notes for the most part, but also just like if you flub something or something happens in the background, or, you know, there can be a recording issue with the microphone, you got to basically set aside about 30 minutes to record and edit each review. So if you got like 10 or 12 of them, that's a whole day.
It can add up fast. This isn't the easiest thing to be doing. Just because it takes an hour to listen to us does not mean it takes an hour to make this show every week.
No.
There's a lot of background work that goes into things.
It's almost a 3-to-1 ratio. The amount of time when you record, then you edit, then you post, then you promote, then you fall asleep.
If you're practiced at it. If you're interested in getting into this sort of thing, there's a lot of learning that goes into it and a lot of practice before you reach a point where it's even 3-to-1. I know when I started making YouTube videos, making a 3-minute video would take me 4 hours. And awesome. I might not be all that active on YouTube anymore, but It's faster, but it's still, there's a lot of extra work that goes into it that you don't really think about when you think, oh, well, I'll buy a microphone and I'll start recording myself talk and boom. So I'll record for 10 minutes. It'll make a 10 minute clip. Doesn't work that way.
No. And it depends on how much of a perfectionist you are in it too.
Yeah. At first, when I started doing reviews for this show, I would go back into my recording and I would eliminate every single breath sound that I made into the microphone. Since then, I've learned a few tricks to reduce how much you hear me breathing just naturally by moving my face away from the microphone when I breathe in.
Go figure. It could be Dodd and I where we just don't care enough anymore.
Yeah, and the smaller breaths I don't care about now, but it's
big ones.
I still cut a little bit if I end a sentence and then breathe. You're not going to hear that in my reviews because it's too obvious, but little breaths where I take in the middle of a sentence, I don't care about those anymore because they sound fine. I don't know why I was so worried about them before, but
podcasting isn't radio. Podcasting is a conversation. It's more like a pure talk radio. And you know, we're not using, you know, $3,000 microphones.
No, and for the most part, you don't need to in this industry. It's not necessary. You don't need thousands of dollars worth of equipment. You don't buy the $30 mic, but you don't buy the $3,000 mic either. You go with something that's going to work for you. I spent $80 on this mic a few years ago, and it served me well the entire time. I love this microphone. It's great. It's a Behringer C1U.
And my mic setup was about $80 or so on sale. And, you know, Birdman's is the same deal. When we're recording, the thing is, people don't realize the more you use these stuff, they do wear down and break. So you do have to replace cables and you have to replace the occasional microphone because, when you're recording 1,000 hours of stuff over the course of a year, year and a half, it does, put wear and tear on everything. So you want to spend a couple $100 probably to start. And again, it depends on your recording environment too. If you're in a very noisy environment, you might have to use a different type of microphone.
Yeah, you might need to invest in soundproofing as well. I don't have any in this room, but this room seems to work well. It's not as good as the studio I had before, but you can get some foam padding, some specialized padding to put on the walls. It might look a little bit unsightly, but it's the kind of thing that you can put a little bit of investment in to improve the quality. It doesn't need to be super expensive, but it's not something you might think of when you're first starting. There's a lot of little things and details that improve the quality of your recording. And that could be the difference between having a podcast that nobody listens to and having something that people enjoy and come back week after week and leave feedback. And you get a community together and you get to actually know the people that enjoy listening.
Yeah. And same with on the software end, it can be anywhere from free software to thousands of dollars you spend on your software. But it's about what finding something that you're comfortable with using. So, that speeds up the process. Free stuff will usually take longer because usually it's less robust. But then again, you get something that's more high end and there's a steeper learning curve. So it's about finding, sort of the middle ground.
But if you are interested and if you want some more ideas on how you could get started with a podcast of your own or a YouTube channel of your own, feel free to give us a shout. Feedback at thisweekingeek.net. We're always listening. We try to reply as quickly as we can. Yeah, just give us a shout and give us your questions.
Yeah, totally. So I think that's going to do it for today. Birdman, I have no idea. Well, he's trying to play the Division, but he's got internet issues, so he can't connect, which that brings into light, always on connections and how that can be troublesome.
Yeah, what do you play when you need the internet to play everything?
Yeah, so I think he's catching up on some visual stuff that he wanted to watch, I guess, for review. Maybe some other games on the side that don't require the internet. But then again, we can't tell because he's not connected to the net right now.
Probably working on the Cambridge Chronicles stuff as well.
Yeah, he's working on some back-end stuff. He always likes to keep up to date on that and scribble down his madman notes.
A little book of terrors that we have to go through afterwards. But that's on Cambridge Chronicles, which you can find at terriblewarriors.com. Shameless plug because, we like people listening to us, and if you want to listen to more of us, you can head over there and give us a listen. We have a full season of what we did recently with Dungeons and Dragons. This year's show will be Shadowrun, so you can look forward to that as well. But that'll do it for this week's show on thisweekingeek.net. My name is Mr. Christopher. I've been joined with
Alex.
So live free and die hard, as Mike would always say. Thank you for listening. We will catch you again here next week on This Week in Geek.
Well, that's our show.
All right, here's the deal. Every time you watch my show,
I will send you $40.
Checks will not be honored.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek, your source for guaranteed nonsense or your money back. Tune in next week for more info on the most important things you didn't need to know. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net and subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head over to this episode's post at thisweekingeek.net and leave a comment through Facebook Connect. Follow us on Twitter at thisweekingeek.net and follow our Instagram at twig_official_podcast. Social media not your thing? Send us an email at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
Just when you think this show is terrible, something wonderful happens.
What?
It ends.
I have to go. Somewhere there is a crime happening.
What the hell, Mongolian, doing here? You, Mongolian! Don't you break down my wall! Get out of here, you Mongolian!
God damn it, how come every time us Chinese put up a wall, stupid Mongolians have to come and knock it down?